Okay, here we go. Why don't we kick it off like we usually do with some music?
All right, yeah, let's do it. Not that many albums this month, so, you know, Wes will be happy about that. Not that many to go through, but definitely some very big sellers.
That's the important thing.
Do you want to bring up anyone you want to talk about, or should I just go?
No, we'll just go through your list, and I only got to listen to one.
Okay.
So
when we get there, you can say so. If it's not on the list, you can bring it up at the end, I guess.
Yeah, and then some of them were, I was not going to listen to Kid Rock. It wouldn't have mattered.
Okay.
If that was the only album that came out.
So as far as big sellers go, Britney Spears releases Britney.
Is that her debut?
No, this is her third album, in fact.
Oh, shit.
If you think about it, just a year prior, she had released Oops, I Did It Again.
Oh, okay.
And this one is going to go 10 times platinum. It's going to sell like crazy.
What were the singles on that one?
I'm a Slave for You,
okay.
Which was actually produced by Neptunes. And again, just from the past, I don't know, year or so of just looking at what's been coming out, Neptunes are responsible for so fucking many big hit singles for all of these different artists. They really are the Renaissance men of production for pop, R&B, hip-hop. They're everywhere. And again, they find themselves producing Slave for You, which is a really, really big hit for her. Aside from that one track, which is produced by them, the rest of the album is produced by Max Martin. We brought up Max Martin many, many times. He's produced albums for Backstreet Boys and NSYNC and, of course, Britney Spears. She's like, if you're wondering, by the way, like, to look and peer into the future, she's going to have an emotional break. She's going to snap, as they say.
As anyone would.
Yes.
Someone who was as heavily scrutinized.
Right. So she's less than a year, a little over a year ago, she made this other, like, 15 times platinum album, and Oops, I Did It Again. Already back with another album, and she's going to go on a, I think it's like 100 concerts and 200 days tour.
Oh, God.
She's going to, while doing that, be filming and doing post-production for the movie Crossroads, which is going to come out. So basically the next 2 years of her life will be non-fucking stop work.
And like in the middle of all of this, there are, and I don't want to generalize, you know, the in quotes media too much, but there are certain members of entertainment media who are just like after her about everything, like her virtue, whether or not she's claiming to be a virgin. Like, shut the fuck up, that's not anybody's business, leave her alone. And yeah. People interviewing about like her endorsements, whether she actually drank Pepsi or not, like, who fucking cares? She's selling the sugar water. Fucking back the fuck off.
Like, do you think that Shaquille O'Neal uses Icy Hot? Like, do you care? He's just endorsing.
Does he have the general insurance?
Right, yeah. Again, there's so many celebrity endorsements. Like, why would anyone... Yeah, they were just looking for a reason to go at her. For whatever reason, they felt like they had a right to. And it's pretty sad. It's very, very sad to look back on it now, because it's so clearly exploitative. But yeah, that's sort of what was expected. And you can totally and again, where this money is going into a conservatorship too, which is the sad part, that really a lot of this stuff is being driven by her dad, you know, who's sort of forcing her to do all of this stuff that if she maybe she was like okay to do with it at the time, but I'm sure at some point there was just like, no, I gotta fucking stop. Like, it's obviously this was an unhealthy scenario for her in spite of her being the world's biggest pop star and getting to go on these grand tours and all this stuff. I'm sure it was an amazing experience, but clearly it fucked her up. So moving on, another big sensation, Shakira, she releases Laundry Service. This is the one that has Whenever Wherever on it, so a really big song, and also Underneath Your Clothes was on this one. This is like, what was her fifth? She's had five albums total. I want to say this was like her,
I think it was her third,
first English language.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, she had, and the last one, we actually talked about it last year being 2000, she had an MTV Unplugged album that came out, but that was, in Spanish language. It sold about 10 million copies. This was a huge, huge album, working with a guy named Lester Mendez, famous for recording with like Nelly Furtado and Santana and Jewel. I enjoy this. It's very, very good. Obviously, Whenever, Wherever is like a delightful headphone candy kind of track. It is a very big track. Good for her. Like, I mean, she's incredible longevity, too. Like, we just saw her, I think, a year or two ago performing at a Super Bowl. So, very, very big crossover artist for, you know, for Latin music and American pop music. Also, speaking of someone who very deftly navigates two different genres, Pink released her album Misunderstood. We had actually just talked about her again a year ago. She had released her debut album, and this is like her smash success, big breakthrough. This one sold 12 million copies, so even more than Britney Spears and Shakira is Pink's Misunderstood. Yeah, yeah, this album.
Well done.
Yeah, and it had that, the Get This Party Started was the big single on it. Yeah, she actually works with this duo of producers that I had really never heard of, Linda Perry and Dallas Austin. And they
have... Named after two cities in Texas.
That's a good point, yeah. It's got its own unique blend of R&B and pop music. I think it's actually kind of works really well for her. She simultaneously can kind of fit in well with both scenes, so I think it gives her a lot of appeal. I don't really like her all that much. I don't think she's that great, but she's got some singles, so good for her. Robert James Ritchie releases his fifth album. You know who that is?
No.
That's our boy Kid Rock.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
So
Kid Rock releases this album, Cocky. And it's one of those things where it's like I could totally just shit on this album, but it's so fun. It is just so bad, but so delightfully bad in the grandeur of it all.
Like Moonfall?
Yeah. Moonfall's actually a great comparison for... in the same way
that... Hold on. So Moonfall is a wonderful comparison to Kid Rock.
Because I think it tracks, yeah.
Weirdest...
Both...
What the...
One is a sci-fi epic of incredible grandeur that just is just laughable. And this is the same thing.
And the other is a movie about the moon falling.
You know what this means, though, right? We need a cut of Moonfall starring Chris Rock.
And then if you play his album right at the right time,
yep.
they sync up.
It's there just,
they, yep, there
it's
we
perfect.
Go.
It's perfect. Like, but like, to get us back on track here, like,
yeah.
When you watch Moonfall, you know why you're there. If you're listening to a Chris Rock album, you probably know why you're there.
Yeah. So, this album is actually...
Sorry, Kid Rock. I said Chris Rock.
I was about to say.
I love Chris Rock.
Yeah, so Kid Rock's album here, it really is a great delivery on what he aspires to do. This actually is the complete realization of his vision for what an album should be. It is this melding of Southern rock, nu metal, rap, country, it's all of it all at the same time. His rapping style is great too. It's surprising how good it, I mean, on its own it's probably not that great, but for the what he's going for here in this album, it's perfect. And it harkens back to like 80s MCs, you know, like the Fat Boys and shit. It's or like go back and listen to early LL Cool J, real big hype rhymes. He's just got this great flow, and he's really deft at being dumb. He's very, very good at being stupid. And it works. And also, this album had a big track called Picture, which he recorded with Sheryl Crow, a ballad. And I think that's the only thing, is that the album is, one, it's super fucking long. It has that big track on it, though. All the other quote-unquote ballady slow songs kind of suck. I like when he's going hard and heavy with the other tracks, especially the first, like, four or five tracks on the album really do land. They're very, very fun. When he starts doing sort of ballady country music is when I kind of lose interest in it on what is a fairly long-winded record. And lastly, he has a track on here with Snoop Dogg, and I kid you not, you should go back and listen to this track because in it he describes himself and Bill Clinton having a three-way.
I don't want to picture that.
Yeah, right?
Okay.
So this is a guy who is, basically going to, like, in modern times, trash the Clintons. He is a MAGA alt-right douchebag. But he has this ridiculous song in which he describes being on an airplane, having a three-way with Bill Clinton.
Anyone else that he mentions by name or just... He wants to...
A guy named Jeffrey Epstein. No. I'm no more Jeffrey Epstein. We're going to get banned. They're going to, like, listen to this and cut us off. All right.
We are proudly anti-Jeffrey Epstein. We do not endorse any of his behaviors.
All we've done is brought up people that have been associated with him. So at any rate, like, we could move on from there.
Both named Bill, weirdly enough.
Yeah. Five times platinum, though. Like, honestly, if... if you don't let other people know that you listen to this album, it's a fun listen. I mean, I'm
like windows up in your car.
I mean, I feel like I'm doing this for the sake of like history. There's a kind of I don't know.
Posterity?
For posterity, I do these. So I actually get to kind of have fun while I listen to some of just the worst music. Okay. And there's going to be a worse record we'll talk about real soon.
Oh, amazing.
And so not this one, though, thankfully. I love this record. Andrew W.K. releases I Get Wet. You guys ever heard of Andrew W.K.
Yep.
or this album I Get Wet?
Nope.
It's
about running in the yard with the sprinklers, right?
Stop it.
No. I think that... so what is it? It's sort of like a bubblegum heavy metal record. Imagine, take the very best elements of like the Rolling Stones and Rock and Roll History Part 1 by Gary Glitter and Def Leppard. Put it all together in this big blender, and it is the most loud, anthemic metal punk pop album you've ever heard. With tracks like, well, for sure, I think there's 11 songs on this album. Four of the 11 songs have the word party in them.
Perfect.
It's it's a really hard album to gauge because there's a certain not irony, but there's a sort of meta understanding of what's going on with this record. For it being as loud and dumb and fun as it is, there is sort of an undertone to what is actually going on with this record. And I think, gosh, what can you say about it? It's the kind of album that... So Pitchfork is an album reviewing website, and they're notoriously the most pretentious assholes. They gave this album a 0.6 out of 10, right?
What kind of score is that? Like, what is the 0.6 positive?
Yeah.
I mean, there's some intense calculations in a review to be like 0.6. Like,
when I was listening to it, I was like, in my mind, I swear to God, I hadn't read the review yet, but I was like, okay, so what does this remind me of? Def Leppard's anthemic arena rock, the Ramones. It reminds me of Gary Glitter's famous Rock and Roll History Part 1. That track, you cannot go to a sporting event and not hear it. It fills arenas so well. And lastly, a song that had just come out, Who Let the Dogs Out.
Mm.
You know that how Who Let the Dogs Out just kind of fucking jumps at you?
Oh, yeah.
This whole album is designed to do exactly that. It's designed to just sort of come at you and not let go, right? And they mentioned all four of those in a negative review. And I was like, that's why this album is amazing. How did you see that in this album but not understand the greatness of it? And I think it's because they took it too literal. I think they think Andrew W.K. is as dumb as this record sounds like it should be. And it's not. I think that it's much smarter than that. And also, noted Sad Sacks at NME, who typically gives scathing reviews, gave it an 8 out of 10 and said it was one of the most fun albums you'll ever listen to. Like, they're like, we don't even know if he's serious or not, but we know this is fun. Mm. So he did his job. This is great. This is really, really good for what it is. Yeah, like, the album is his face with blood running down it, and it's because he hit himself in the face with a brick before doing the photo shoot. Like, this guy is just...
Oh, he was legitimately
bonkers.
Bleeding.
Yeah. No, he's absolutely nuts. He is manic in his desire to party. And that's...
Yeah. He needs to go to the hospital. Like, you know, you can, like, dye corn syrup red, my friend. You don't need to...
I find so fun. There's almost kind of a fascistic level to this album.
It's like, we're having a party. We forgot the pinata. Don't worry, I got this.
Yeah, no, he is insisting you party. There's a there is a mandate that you will party.
A mandate to party. Yeah.
Right? Like, that's kind of what this record is.
That's the title of his next album.
And it's just so fun.
Okay, so he's bleeding from his nose. So he broke his nose?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
During the photo shoot, yeah.
To this day, he can't smell.
But, and what an iconic album cover, though, right?
Yeah,
like, it's great. So this album is absolutely wonderful. I would totally recommend it if you like just big anthemic music, and just an album that is just like, I don't know what uppers you take, but it is probably like doing a line of coke and then just going screaming into traffic naked.
This is a POD album and an Andrew WK.
Yeah. Another album, Silver Jews, Bright Flight. So this is the fourth album. They're an indie rock band from New York. It's a country record, though. And I can't believe the singer sings. He's just got, like, the boringest voice. The whole album's super boring. It got really good reviews, so I'm probably the worst person to review this album. But I bring it up. It was
they're all wrong.
Yeah. It was very, very popular on the album of the year website for this month, which is only why I bring it up. it almost sounds like it's kind of ironic, like there's kind of this tongue-in-cheek angle to it, like they know that they're New York hipsters, and why are they making a country record?
Like that country song in Team America?
Yeah. Well, so Ween actually has an album called 12 Country Greats, which is, like, it's called, there's 12 tracks on it, but those aren't the 12 great country songs. They brought in actual country musicians, long-storied careers as session musicians for country recordings, and made just a weird out-there album, and I feel like this album kind of wants to be that, but it's also a little too self-serious. I don't know. It's just not very fun. I didn't really enjoy it all that much. But it is certainly better than the next album that we're going to talk about, Creed Weathered.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, so this is... they're going to sell 6 million copies of this.
What were the singles on this one?
One Last Breath and My Sacrifice.
Okay.
Do you guys remember we talked about T.I. and T.I. saved Scott Stapp's life?
Yep. Caught him out of a window.
Yeah.
You should have let him drop, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
This album might have already been cut. We don't know.
Yeah, I believe that happened way later. Scott Stapp has struggled with alcohol problems his whole life. I didn't really know much about the history of this band or anything like that. I just know them from their big singles and needlessly melancholy lyrics and morose attitude. I don't know. I don't really like it all that much. From actually listening to it, because again, I listen to all of these albums. I'm not just saying them. I listen to all of these records, most of them multiple times. I made it through this one once, and I listened to the two big singles a couple extra times just
on 1.5 speed.
Yeah, I wish. Mark, their guitarist is named Mark Tremonti. He's fantastic. He is a really talented guitarist. His guitar tones are really good too. It actually is kind of enjoyable to go back and listen to a Creed record. I just wish they were instrumentals. Because I really don't connect with Scott Stapp's voice, what he's singing about. It's all very, I don't know, naive and stupid in a way. I don't know. I shouldn't go in on this guy.
I think, like, to your point, like, the sort of, like, serious, like, gravity in his voice when he is singing. And, like, it's like he thinks... what he's singing about is deeper than just sort of like the surface level lyrics that he's bellowing out.
He's presuming it's the most profound thing you've heard.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, at least Nickelback, they know they're dirtbags, right? He's kind of thinking he's elevating your life by giving you this message.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to sing at the top of a mountain with my button-down shirt popped open and the wind blowing and my hair flying. No, you're not singing about anything of consequence here.
Yeah. All right, well, moving on, one more album in this pop rock category. Josh Groban, which, why would it be pop rock? This is contemporary classical music, but he's sort of going to be a big name in that world of contemporary classical. He's
voice of a generation.
Yeah, yeah, he has an incredible voice, singing a combination of, not show tunes, but just like these classical songs and... I don't know.
Like covers and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Sold 5 million copies doing it. I'm not really a fan of him. I knew a few of the songs that he had recorded from looking at his entire...
Does he do original songs?
Like, discography. Yeah, he's got some original songs. He'll do whole albums of different, like, varieties of cover songs, being classical opera songs, doing stage, like, show tune musicals, doing original recordings for other artists, Christmas albums, all that shit. He does it all. He's going to have a huge, huge career, of course. And it's good, again, like, actually very, very nice to listen to. Not my style, but for sure, I would recommend anyone listen to that if they're wondering why I don't ever bring up classical crossover artists. There you go, there's Josh Groban, sold 5 million copies. Hip-hop and R&B, Ghostface Killah released Bulletproof Wallets. If you don't know who that is, he is a member of the Wu-Tang Clan. He has an album here produced with RZA, and RZA produces a lot of the Wu-Tang Clan, or pretty much all of the Wu-Tang Clan's material. It's a little bit more upbeat than his usual productions. It's not so much that gritty grindhouse like samurai shit. It's more, I don't know, more soulful sample driven music. It's nice enough, but like, I don't know, I never really liked Ghostface Killah all that much, and it's the same cash money rules everything around me kind of attitude. So it's a lot of drug dealer shit that I don't care about. One of my favorite albums of the month, Ludacris, releases Word of Mouth. MOUF. I love Ludacris so much. He's just he's so funny. I think that's what's so great about him, is that he's so funny, but he's never the joke. He's never making outright jokes. He's just got this really fun and clever wordplay that's put atop hardcore southern hip hop. He's from Atlanta. This is his second album, too. We talked about his first album like a year ago, less than a year ago, called Back Again for the First Time, mm-hmm. or something like that. Again, one of the best flows in the game. Great, great wordplay. Just fucking hilarious. You gotta love this guy. He's awesome. Tracks like Rollout, Area Codes, Move Bitch, all big songs. Working with a mostly this guy named Bangladesh, who doesn't really have the longest production credits, but has produced albums for him and a few other guys. But Bangladesh, Timbaland, a name we should know by now, and Organized Noize. Guests like 3-6 Mafia, Nate Dogg, Mystical, I-20, Twista. Just great, great sampling of artists to appear on.
Academy Award winners, 3-6 Mafia.
Yep, yep, love them. That would be great if they did. Wait, did they win an Academy Award?
Yeah.
For what?
I just remember that the joke was like, oh, so here's the scorecard, 3-6 Mafia, what Academy Award? Martin Scorsese, zero.
Well, I mean,
so yeah, this was before The Departed, obviously.
Yeah, Memphis is finest. Okay, so Busta Rhymes releases Genesis. This is his fifth album in a row that would go platinum. It has probably his biggest song ever, Break Your Neck. He's got that kind of, we just mentioned Twista. It's Twista Tech N9ne. He's one of those guys that just raps really fucking fast, just like crazy wordplay. I like it. The producers on this album, though, are made one of the best runs of producers I've ever seen credited on a hip-hop album. Dr. Dre, our boys Neptunes, at it again. Just Blaze, J Dilla, and Pete Rock. Like, holy shit, that's a great, great collection of producers to have for an album. I honestly think Busta Rhymes' solo albums are never that great. I think he works better as a guest artist, but like with that, you know, murderer's row of producers, this album is just fantastic. So, definitely recommend it. Also another good one. UGK, which is two guys named Pimp C and Bun B, big guys in Southern hip-hop, like the Cash Money, No Limits sound, which is kind of now phasing out, and we're kind of getting into some new sounds. But at any rate, they released this album, Dirty Money. It's good for what it is. If you want some gritty, you know, gritty drug dealer rhymes over trap beats, or, well, proto-trap beats, you got it. Lovage. Lovage, Music to Make Love to Your Old Lady By is the name of this album.
Oh, you should never end a sentence with a preposition.
Yeah, the turns out they did. It's Dan the Automator, Jennifer Charles, and believe it or not, guess who's back? Our boy. Mike Patton.
Oh, Mike Patton. That was my next guess.
Mike Patton, who is, again, the guy that sings the Ninja Turtles theme song.
Yep.
So, this album doesn't really work that well. It's supposed to be kind of like a romantic, down-tempo trip-hop album, and Mike Patton shouldn't be doing that. He should be singing Ninja Turtles theme songs.
All day, every day.
Yeah, he's trying his damnedest, but it doesn't
just
really work.
Just keep making more. It's like, we're not making any more movies. Doesn't matter. I have plenty of material.
Now that every video game is going to have the Ninja Turtles.
Yeah.
You can just keep on doing songs for
those. He just keeps coming. Yeah. Like, I have 15 albums of Ninja Turtles stuff made, a brand new, all original.
I like it. Oh, yeah, the good songs on there are the ones where Jennifer Charles leads. She has a very sultry and seductive voice that works well for this. A couple punk albums to talk about. Minus the Bear releases This Is What I Know About Being Gigantic. I love this band so fucking much. This is like one of my
sounds like
bands.
A kid's show.
It's get what you know why they called them themselves Minus the Bear?
Why is that?
Because there was a TV show called BJ and the Bear.
Oh, so
it's BJ.
So there's a member in the band named BJ.
Yeah, it's BJ and the Bear Minus the Bear. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, so that's what they're going for. I love this band. It's math rock, but it's like emo.
What was the name of the album again?
This Is What I Know About Being Gigantic.
Okay,
they're notorious for having long song titles that are. Like Absinthe Party at the Fly Warehouse, Get Me Naked 2, Electric Boogaloo. Like, just these really ridiculously long-winded songs. Monkey Knife Fight.
That's fun.
But if you listen to their lyrics, they're not silly. What they're doing is sort of advertising this lifestyle of, like, yachts and women and drinking wine and stuff like that. It's very, very sophisticated and cool for the kind of music they make, which is, you think of emo and you think of math rock, and you don't really ever get, like, cool from that. You get, I don't know.
You don't get cool from math rock?
No, not at all. No, you get like dorky guys wearing like skinny long sleeve shirts and stuff, you know, trying to play guitars.
With the holes punched out on the sleeves so they can like...
I think so, yeah. Yeah, the hand glove thing? Yeah.
Your brother
about.
Did that.
Oh, gosh. Was he in a math rock band?
No.
No, he played the flute.
Oh, God. So,
I forgot about the flute.
Two interesting things I think about this band. Dave Cudson is in this, and Dave Cudson was in a band called Botch. And Botch is like a metalcore band from the late 90s that's really, really influential and really fucking good. I would totally recommend people listen to them. They have an album called We Are the Romans, which is a banger. It is so good. And as heavy and hard as that is, this is not that at all. He does a lot of finger tapping, too. So, you know, a lot of the strum guitar. What he does is he taps, the two guitarists in the band will tap the frets.
Mm-hmm.
To sort of create this sort of twinkling sound to more akin to a piano, I guess you could say. And when you have two guys doing it at the same time, it just creates these very dizzying, beautiful melodies. And that's kind of what they're doing. They're doing that over these like really groove bass lines and drum fills. And again, it does create this really sophisticated, classy sounding music. It's hard to describe. I really just recommend you listen to it. This is their first EP. We're going to talk about them a bunch over the next few years because they release so many good records. This band is just only going to go up. They are going to fucking skyrocket. Not in sales, but certainly in quality of music. I love this band.
Even though they're short a bear.
Yeah, they're minus one bear, but mm-hmm. They're certainly up on good tunes. Get Up Kids releases a compilation album called Eudora. Get Up Kids are a big part of the 90s Midwest emo scene.
This is one I listened to.
Oh, really? What'd you think?
Yeah. I thought it was good. Yeah. I think that there are a couple of covers on it that I didn't even recognize as covers. But I think they were really talented, really well produced, really nice sound. A lot of the songs reminded me of either Yellow Card or Fall Out Boy or Taking Back Sunday. And as I'm listening to it, it's like, yeah, this kind of sounds like this. This kind of sounds like that. Why am I not liking these as much as I like the other ones? And I liked all these songs just fine, but I think what they were missing were like some really good hooks. They should have been working with the Neptunes to write some songs for them, because I think like from what I was hearing, they are just as capable as like a band like Fall Out Boy, who had some longevity, or Taking Back Sunday, or Yellow Card, who's kind of a flash in the pan, but mm-hmm. like had at least one really great album. I think that just as talented as any one of them, but they didn't have like the strong like chorus hook.
I love a good violin in a rock song.
That's where they peaked.
I love it.
That's where they peaked.
So good.
I would be willing to put money that every member of all of those bands you just mentioned are big fans of the Get Up Kids and are heavily influenced by the Get Up Kids. The sound wouldn't exist.
I wouldn't doubt it.
Yeah. So they have an album called 4 Minute Mile and one called Something to Write Home About, which precede this. They came out in the mid-90s and late-90s, respectively. And yeah, I think it's weird to say that your favorite album from a band is a compilation record with none of the songs from those albums. But that's, for me personally, Eudora is their best record. I think it is a weird snapshot because of all the different cover songs they do. You get a weird snapshot of who these guys are. You know, whether it's a Cure track, a Pixies track is on there.
Oh, that's right.
A Motley Crue track. David Bowie. It's all over the place, but at the same time, it all kind of makes sense in their sound. And also, there's a song on here called Forgive and Forget, which was not even released on Something to Write Home About, which I find surprising, because this is their, like, in my personal opinion, this is their best song they ever wrote. This is my favorite song by far from this band, and they've got a number of good singles. I don't know how this got left on the cutting room floor of what is regarded as their best album, because this song is so, so good. I love it so much. It really does capture, you know, this is like there's the emo thing where they're all just kind of like whiny and shit, and this is one of those songs that I think really does capture, you know, emotional rock. This is a very emotional song, very, very pretty song. So all in all, I really do like this album a lot. I think it's worth checking out and very informative of the next 5 to 10 years of what emo is going to become. Moving on, not that many more records. We'll get out of here real soon. Tim Hecker releases Haunt Me, Haunt Me, Do It Again. He's from Vancouver. He makes drone music, probably one of the biggest names in drone. I love him. He's going to make an album called Radio Amor in a couple of years. So that is, for me, top three drone albums ever made. It's un-fucking believable. But we're talking about his debut here. It's weird. Typically we think of drone albums, you think of music that's going to sort of be in the background and stuff. This one's actually really fun to actively listen to. There's a lot going on with it. He really does find these really wonderful ways to fill space, with these very kind of bright and shimmering songs of, just layers of ambient sound. Very, very nice. And did this cool thing. It's for it being an ambient record, it's 50 minutes long, which is very short for an ambient record. But it's 20 tracks. And what he'll do is he'll have maybe the opening track. It'll be like, you know, the what is it, like Boreal Wave, part one. And it'll be like 6 minutes long. And it'll sort of be the complete thought. But then part two and three will be the next two tracks. And it'll each be like maybe 30 seconds or a minute long. And what they are is sort of deconstructions of the sounds from the first part, which is something I love about the way that he did this album, is that you oftentimes will hear these drone records and not really get a sense of what this mesh of music is. And he compartmentalizes it all. He breaks it out. It's sort of like you look at a finished painting, but then you also get to look at the palette that the painter was working with and see where they mixed all the colors together, you know? So the fact that he has these complete songs and then these little snippets almost afterwards that showcase where the sounds come from really brings it alive, makes it so much more enjoyable to listen to actively. Again, I'll say it again, Tim Hecker, Haunt Me, his debut record. This guy makes incredible drone, so just check him out. He's really, really good. A group, an English post-rock band called Hood, I'd never heard of these guys, released an album called Cold House. I fell in love with this record so much. I'd never heard of these guys before this, but I fell in love with this record. It's two of the guys from Clouded are on three different songs on here. We talked about this band Clouded months back. I don't expect you guys to remember them. They were kind of a footnote. But they're back here again, making essentially this, probably what's informed by Radiohead in the English rock scene. They're making just these very icy, cold record of just really beautiful post-rock music. Strongly recommend it. Absolutely give it a listen. I loved it. Ulrich Schnauz. He is a German producer. He made this album called Faraway Trains Passing By. He will eventually become a member of Tangerine Dream. Tangerine Dream is really big in progressive music and has been for like fucking 40 years. They're one of the longest running progressive bands. But what did he make here? He made some ambient soundscapes. I think this is a really nice record to listen to. It's very present. Again, very bright, shimmering, down-tempo music. Only thing I would say about it is that it almost feels a little corporate. It almost feels a little new agey at times. It's maybe a little too polished. It kind of lacks any of the grit that you would maybe expect from, you know, supposed to be ostensibly ambient techno, but not really. One last album producer for electronic music, Monolake releases CinemaScope. He's a German producer. Wes got the yawns. I'm sorry, dude.
I'm sorry. That came out of nowhere.
But yeah, there's like a lot of like the ambient electronic stuff. There's a lot of German.
Yeah, German people. Germany produces some of the best albums. Hmm. I don't know. It's their sound. It's what they're into. I mean, it's where Kraftwerk's from. Kraftwerk's like one of the original electronic.
I guess it makes sense because for three decades they weren't allowed to sing.
Yeah, that's a good point. You couldn't trust them with the words anymore. Back to their old
habits. They had a quiet time.
So yeah, I don't know if you guys even remember me talking about Monolake. He released an album called Gravity. I love this guy so much. Monolake makes ambient techno, and he's the name of the game. He's one of the best to ever do it. This album veers a little more into glitch, so it's not as mellow and not as chill as some of his other stuff is, but I think it's a good record. Couple of metal albums. Devin Townsend releases Teria. People will tell you it's a good record. I don't think it's that great a record. I think he's got a great guitar tone, and he's a talented guitarist, but he makes long-winded prog rock that I don't care about that much. Windeer is a Norwegian black metal. They released an album called 1184. This one's a banger. Real ripper. Absolutely listen to this one. It is so, so good. Windir album is 1184. I guess 1184. There is actually a surprising amount of synth in it, and there is supposed to be sort of this folkish influence, but not really. It is just a ripper of a black metal album, and I would strongly recommend people listen to it. It's the heaviest album of the month by far, and it goes. Rob Zombie releases an album called The Sinister Urge. You guys know who Rob Zombie is? Mm-hmm. You know a little bit about him?
Yeah, he made those Halloween movies.
Yeah, he sure did. He's a director. So he's sort of like known for industrial metal, I guess. And for this album, for what it is, it's pretty good. I don't really like it all that much, just because I've never been a big fan of his sound. But if you want, like, I don't know, what is it, B-movie industrial metal / stripper anthems, that's what this is. It's very well produced. He certainly gives it to you. Terry King from Slayer and Ozzy are on this album, too, so some good guests. My Dying Bride releases The Dreadful Hours. They are doom, death,
sinister.
Yeah, they're not. I always feel like their album should be better than they are because they've been around since the early '90s and they're responsible for death doom. That
they've had a lot of practice
mixing of doom metal and death metal, and it's with varying results. This is not a particularly great record, in my opinion. I think aside from their early '90s albums, this is a band in general that's not that great. I'm being very mean. People love this band, though. People love this My Dying Bride. They love
it. And they're all wrong.
They've never clicked with me for whatever reason. And by far a bad album, Seven Dust releases Animosity. They're a new metal band. Sounds like a watered-down Slipknot. So they were actually probably one of the better-selling records here, but I think...
Yeah, that rings a bell. Do you have any, like, the singles listed?
Oh, I didn't write them down for this album. This one, I don't think had their big album, their big singles, but, you know, they did their thing. No, let me see real quick. I can sure I can get you some titles. So, tracks such as Black Denial, Enemy, Praise.
Nah, that's not right.
None of those sound familiar.
No.
Well, we're not cutting into this podcast with any of their songs. There's better.
No, we certainly are not.
And that's the end of the run. So.
Oh, very good.
Again, as usual, thanks for humoring me.
Yeah,
a lot of records.
I did intend to listen to more, but I usually listen to these things at work, and if things get busy and people don't leave me alone, it makes it difficult.
Yeah.
I just don't listen to music.
Mm-hmm.
Court order?
Yep.
Yeah.
Not allowed to dance. Court order.
We got some movies, fellas.
Yeah, yeah. I watched three.
This was a good month, though, because I'm now looking at the list here. And there's some good stuff on that
the
list.
The list I sent you, and don't look at the box office numbers. I got a quiz.
Oh, right, right.
I didn't look either. Okay. Well, let's start at the top. Domestic Disturbance.
Right, yeah. A Travolta vehicle about a murder, but that got a 24% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Perfect. The Travolta special.
Did you guys watch this one?
No.
Do you know anything about it?
No, I know that John Travolta's in it now.
Yeah, I didn't. There was like four different movies that fit into the generic crime or spy
thriller.
Or
I'm guessing it's about some sort of domestic disturbance.
Stop it.
Am I wrong?
I believe the premise has something to do with Travolta witnessing or being blamed for a murder or something. It's so tropey and generic. Of a plot. I don't care. Can we move on?
Yep. Do you have any numbers for that one?
Oh, numbers. Yeah, for sure. What was the budget?
Budget was...
not a clue.
$20 million.
Keep in mind, he is just off of the rocket ship of success that was Battlefield Earth.
$20 million. I'm sticking with it.
25.
75.
Whoa.
Big budget for this one.
Whoa.
Yeah.
They have explosions and water effects and shit?
Probably. I mean, I don't know. They got the Zethans there or whatever, the spirits from the volcanoes that the Scientologists believe in.
I thought those are the things from Final Fantasy Spirits Within.
Oh, yeah.
Both. Maybe it's both.
Yeah, probably both.
And this movie made... I don't think this movie did well. I think of $50 million. It did not make...
I'm sticking with 25.
Okay.
54.
Okay.
So, yeah, it didn't make its money back, but it wasn't a huge bomb.
Mm.
Okay, what do we got next?
Monsters, Inc., fellas.
Yeah.
Oof.
Wow. I watched this one.
Yeah? I've seen this movie many times.
Yeah, a lot.
You know, I had actually never seen it.
Oh, no?
This was my first viewing of it.
What did you think?
I thought it was actually pretty good.
Yeah.
I like the animation in it a lot. I think it's very fun. Love all of the voice actors.
Mm.
What a great
John country. Goodman.
Yeah, Nathan Lane, Steve Buscemi, lizard guy.
Yeah,
I thought that they were all fantastic.
Yeah, really well cast.
Had a good sense of humor about it. It didn't really feel like it was pandering to kids.
And it does like the Pixar thing, and Pixar's going to be famous for this, where it just takes like a really simple premise and just like lets it play out. It doesn't do any exorbitant sort of like world building. Like it'll show you a few things and let you infer a lot of things about what they're doing. But I was like, no, with it, there's this one plot and we're going to follow that through. Rather than like having all these B plots and stuff going on.
And it's a really cool high concept premise, right? You know, that there's a monster community that exists and they run. It's also a very much a green 21st century problem that Pixar would address, is that there is an energy crisis. They made a movie about a fucking energy crisis.
Yeah, you know?
Like the prequels talk about a fucking dispute within the Senate and it sucks, but they're telling us about an energy crisis and it lands.
Here it comes. And we're also, this, we're going to see like the continued rise of Pixar, while like the regular Disney Animation Studio is going to stagnate. And of course, Pixar is working very closely, if not outright owned by Disney at this point. I don't remember when they purchased them outright, but Pixar is going to be the breadwinner for several years until Disney starts to get its act together again.
Yeah, by getting their act together, you mean going back to the thing that's always worked for them, making Disney Princess movies?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. The only thing that I thought was a little weird is the fact that the uncanny valley of the children in it, like the creepiest thing in it was not the monsters, it was kind of the children.
Right.
Like they just hadn't quite figured out how to animate a human.
Yeah, I think there is a reason why, you know, these early Pixar movies, I think Monsters, Inc. and Toy Story, well, you do see children, but it's not going to focus on the human characters.
Yeah. And one other little thing I wanted to bring up. So, do you guys know what adrenochrome is?
No.
So, adrenochrome is, and I don't want to get too much into this, but...
No, let's do it.
You know that there's that crazed conspiracy cult QAnon?
Oh, sure, yeah, the baby blood and shit.
Yeah. That's essentially what they're doing. This Monsters, Inc., in a way, is telling the narrative of what the QAnon people think adrenochrome is, and that they're torturing children to extract this energy that feeds them like they're vampires.
Mm.
So, like, I couldn't help but be like, this is adrenochrome that they're extracting from these poor children.
But then in the end, it turns out that laughter is more powerful.
Yeah, you know, all they had to do was just show the kids some...
Tell some jokes, do some physical comedy. Some
Daniel Tosh stand-up, and they would have been way better off.
But slightly less erotic, hopefully.
I find it interesting, you went straight to Daniel Tosh, of all things.
I've recently been rewatching some Daniel Tosh stand-up. He's actually, I don't know, it's pretty funny.
Yeah, I enjoy Daniel Tosh.
I don't know why I had to bring him up there. There's probably
punching
better.
The kid across. How did you break your foot? Punching the kid's head off.
Well, what do you guys think on it? What's your opinion on Monsters, Inc.?
I mean, it's Monsters, Inc. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Mike Wazowski, come on.
Yeah.
He's going to be in a Zelda game in the future.
Is he?
Mike Wazowski, yeah. And in a cameo.
Oh, right. In Skyward Sword.
But yeah, very good. Budget.
Oh, yeah. By the way, big reviews, 96% on Rotten Tomatoes. How could someone hate this movie? What do you think the budget was?
I don't know how much an anime movie would be. We'll go with 75.
I'm going to go lower. I will say 40 million.
40 million. They pulled out the big bucks for this one. 115.
Oof. Whoa.
Yeah. The third most expensive movie. Tied for second most expensive movie. At any rate, box office.
No, it's got to be like 200, something like that. I don't know.
600 million.
560. 560. Nice. And here's the thing. It could have done better.
Yeah?
If you think about it. Well, yeah. With the timing of when this released, it was released with something that everyone knew was going to be a big smash hit. We'll talk about it in just a few seconds. So, I'll bury the lead, whatever. But
that's a very good point.
If this thing had the entire month in the box office to do its thing, it probably would have made 800 million. Honestly, there's probably a couple hundred million it's going to lose to another movie.
Hmm.
So, that's all.
The One, starring Jet Li.
Yeah, that's like a Jet Li sci-fi multiverse thing.
Yeah.
Where it's like shifting through different timelines or something.
And there was a time, we've talked a lot about Jackie Chan on this podcast over the past couple of years. There was a time where, it was because they're like the torch being passed where Jet Li was going to be the next action star.
I want to say he had one called Kiss the Dragon. I don't know if that was before or after this.
You know, it's not like he had a failure of a career, but he never really achieved the sort of stardom that Jackie Chan.
Well, he's a bit more serious. I think Jackie Chan's physical comedy comes through with what he does, and Jackie Chan seems like he wants to be like the serious action star.
Mm.
Yeah, that was the big thing, is Jackie Chan is doing these crazy stunts, and they're really entertaining. While cracking jokes here and there with it, and it's like
I don't want
Rush Hour and Shanghai and all this other stuff, where Jet Li is more like, I'm a guy who take the car off, I'm gonna go insane and shit. What movie was that?
These men are chasing us, as they should.
As they
so well. Draw you a bubble bath and slap your bottom.
As well they should.
I'll just go tell my girlfriend.
Oh, man. So, by the way, directed by James Wong, who is famous for having done Final Destination.
Mm.
So, not a great anything with that sentence. not
much pedigree there. This is no Malignant, that's for sure.
I don't think I've actually even seen this movie. I don't know if you guys have.
I've seen it once.
Yeah.
But tell us everything you remember.
I can't remember shit about this movie.
Were there any trains?
Was there in fact a multiverse? Was he?
Yeah, there was like a version of him who was traveling through multiverses, killing other versions of himself.
Okay, like
in
a Highlander.
In order to get stronger.
Okay, like a Highlander.
And like the one, like the last one is like Jet Li, but he's like a cop or something.
Like a Highlander.
Yeah.
It sounds like this one movie I've heard of. What is
Highlander?
It? Yes. Yes.
Oh, budget. I'll go first this time. I'll say $30 million.
$30 million.
I'm going 50.
Ooh, Wes, almost on the dot. 49.
Ooh, well done.
Oof.
How'd it do in the box office?
50.
I think it did pretty well. I will go higher. I'll say 60. 60 million.
72.
Oof.
So it actually did okay. It did all right. What's your next movie?
Heist.
I watched this movie.
How is it?
I love it.
Good.
I love the director, so I will...
What is it? I don't know this movie at all.
David Mamet made it.
Well,
this
it's
is,
about a heist.
This is one of, again, I think four fairly generic crime/spy thrillers that came out in this month. But I see David Mamet, and I'm going to watch it. I just love David Mamet. He's best known as a writer. He's written a lot more movies than he's directed. But he's done some bigger ones. He did a trilogy of films with the actor Joe Mantegna. Joe Mantegna, you may know, is the voice of Fat Tony from The Simpsons. But he did one called Things Change, one called The House of Games, I think it was called. I just really... He wrote a movie called The Verdict. He was the writer for a movie called The Verdict that came out well before that. I can't even think of the other one. He had a huge film that he wrote that ended up being a big success, I think, back in the 80s.
He's got some good people on it.
Yeah. stars Gene Hackman, Danny DeVito, Sam Rockwell, Delroy Lindo is in it. I think that if Mamet's got a distinct style. I keep talking about the director because the director is such a big part of this. He has this very distinct style where he is subdued. In a movie like this, there could have always been a gunfight that doesn't necessarily happen. What happens is people talk about not they talk their way out of having a gunfight, which is far more interesting than watching a gunfight.
I agree.
Yeah.
I mean that's yeah.
The characters in it and the dialogue and the way that they communicate with things is really fascinating. He just has a way of talking where characters will have a conversation that, you know, doesn't play out the way so many scripts are written in a way where they're bludgeoning you with the plot of a story. He has this way of finessing you into a narrative with just having characters have interesting exchanges. And I think it Gene Hackman really carries the movie. He's the lead guy in it. And I think that if the only thing is that there's maybe just, as a narrative goes, just so many fucking double crosses. This is just like too many double crosses all at once, all over the place with everybody that it's just like, it's the point where it's just like, okay, all right, it happened. It's over. Are we done? Is everyone dead? Can we move on?
Did everyone double cross everyone?
Yeah. But I really love it. Generally, the premise is Gene Hackman is forced to do one last score that he doesn't really want to do. He would simply rather retire with his, isn't his wife, but his lover.
His lady.
Yeah, and then DeVito and DeVito's cousin or nephew, Sam Rockwell's character, are sort of pulling him to do that one last heist that he doesn't want to do.
Mm.
Yeah, it's great. It is really, really great. Just don't expect this to be like fucking Ronin or something. Don't expect this to be a huge action movie. Just go in with the idea that you're going to see some very very good performances in a very well written movie.
All right, Wes, you go first this time.
Budget.
80.
I keep
no. That's too high. That's too high.
You're locked in. I keep lowballing. And I think it would be a mistake. I'm not going to go higher than that.
Because it got Danny DeVito and Gene Hackman.
I don't think Danny DeVito might
make a lot at this point. I don't know how good of an actor.
I would give Danny DeVito all my money.
We saw Batman Returns.
Anything what it takes for Danny DeVito, just do it.
I'm going to go lower. I'll leave a window there. I'll go $60 million.
$60 million. So get this. This was his biggest budget he's ever had in a movie. Still only $39 million.
Hmm.
Yeah. Box office.
You're going first again.
50. This is a safe bet. Just go 50.
I don't know. I'm going to wager that this movie did not clean up. $39 million budget. I'm going to say it didn't make its money back, $30 million.
You're actually pretty close, 28. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, this movie wasn't a huge success. I think that this is definitely a movie for, you know, for critics and sad sacks like me.
Yeah, they probably, the one made money, come on.
They probably made the money back in DVD sales, though.
Yeah, I think that if you just look up Mamet's films, he's just a really great director. Yeah, he's not a famous guy. He doesn't...
VHS sales?
Yeah.
DVD was out in 2001.
Yeah, for sure.
We talked about The Matrix already.
Oh, also, it's just generic as fuck. It's Heist. There was literally another movie in 2001 called The Heist that came out.
And there's a movie last month called Bandits.
Yeah. And then there's, like, The Heistening. And
I mean, we'll talk about
and
a couple...
here we heist again. I don't know.
I mean, obviously, Domestic Disturbance is generally a different plot. But, like, when you look at the cover art for, like, Domestic Disturbance and then The Heist and the two more movies we're going to talk about in a minute, it's like, holy fuck, there's just so many generic fucking movies. But this one stands out. This one is different than the other ones.
Next one on the list is Shallow Hal, fellas.
I wanted to, but I didn't get around to watching this one.
I don't think I would have been able to bring myself to do it.
I can't. This, I like Jack Black, but
there's
can't.
No way. Like, this movie, like, at the time was in poor taste. There's no way this is age well. So the general premise, I think this is a Farrelly Brothers movie, is it?
Yeah. They're very in poor taste people, but they're very funny. I think they make great movies.
Jack Black
can make great movies.
Jack Black is our title character. He's Shallow Hal, and he is very much a person who's attracted to the opposite sex based on looks alone. He like has some sort of like curse or something put on him, or blessing, I guess, depending on your perspective. Where
he sees people feels inner beauty, right? Rather than their outer beauty.
And then generally, this like the premise is like he falls in love with Gwyneth Paltrow, who is a heavier set woman in the reality of the movie, but he sees her as a what he would consider more attractive.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like liar, I guess you could say. Maybe it's a sort
Like a distorted perception of reality. He's forced into a perspective.
Yeah. So, I didn't get around to seeing it. Yeah, I'm sure that it's very politically incorrect.
Very probably misogynistic.
By today's standards.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I should hope that's the point, is that he's learning a lesson about not judging people by their physical appearance, and that it's important to see who they are.
Admire optimism.
Are you telling me that's not the idea? I just remember the one thing is there's this really sad scene where he's like at a burn unit or something, and there's like this poor little girl who's like this very pretty girl, or very pretty kid or something, and he's just like... No, you're beautiful, and the kid's like just totally fucked up.
I'm sure that I'm sure probably what the
and it was not
going for.
That certainly was not played for laughs.
But I'm just skeptical at how successfully the Farrelly Brothers can pull something like that off.
Oh yeah.
I'm sure they're giving it their best shot.
Yeah, right. I mean, are these the guys behind like you know fucking There's Something About Mary?
Yeah,
you know, like
yeah, they'll remake the Heartbreak Kid at some point.
What was the bowling movie? Didn't they do that bowling movie?
Kingpin?
Was that them?
I don't think so.
Was them. Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. Or Dumb and Dumber. Like, these guys are great. Yeah. Or am I thinking of somebody else?
I think they... Me, Myself, and Irene.
Yeah. That's a good movie.
Okay.
Agree to disagree. It's a great movie.
Sounds good to me. Okay. Budget.
I went first
time. I go first this time. Ooh, should I steal his $50 million? I'm tempted. $45 million.
Ooh, 45. What do you got?
I don't know. I don't know how big Jack Black was at this time. I don't know. I'll go 40.
On the dot.
Oh shit!
Yeah.
Wash that down a nice salt glass of suck it.
How big? He just had Tenacious D come out. That's a good point. We were just talking about that album. I think a month or two ago.
I think this movie made $80 million.
Okay. What do you got?
Going with 90.
140.
Oof.
Yeah.
Big
this,
hit.
This did very, very well.
And this is Price is Right rule, so I win again.
Well, yeah, you were also closer.
Yeah.
It's the only adult kind of comedy, really. Like, yeah, there's action movies, there's kids comedy, and there's suspense movies, but at this time in the box office, yeah, this was your big draw for people that want something in more of a mature humor.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Mature in quotes.
Yeah.
Spy Games. Oh, wait, no. Hang on. Harry Potter.
Oh, yeah, that one came out.
Yeah. That Harry Potter movie.
Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone.
And the Philosopher's Stone in the UK.
And this is what I was talking about when I was like, Monsters, Inc. could have made $800 million. Mm. I think if not for the fact that this movie came out like 2 weeks after it.
Yeah. This movie's a phenomenon.
Oh, yeah.
It's, based on some novellas, I think.
Still a huge thing to this day, it is. Yeah, yeah, it would launch the careers of a bunch of young actors. Directed by Chris Columbus, who you probably...
Discovered the Americas?
Yeah. who famous for directing...
Stop it.
Famous for directing Home Alone. And I think that if there is a good comparison to this movie, it is Home Alone in a weird way. I think that they both have kind of this magical realism to them,
yes,
where you're seeing the life through the eyes of a child.
If you're not familiar with like the premise of Harry Potter, Harry Potter is this orphan boy who goes to live with some like adjacent relatives, but it's kind of like a Cinderella situation where he's like doing all the chores and taking care of the family, and they're all kind of like mooching off of him. He, like, his room is under the stairs, there's a little cabinet, and then he suffers a psychotic break where he thinks that he has magical powers and he's going to go to this magical school and learn how to do magic and become like this world-saving hero.
Yeah. There's this read that we're all schizophrenic, but we just see a rational reality.
Yeah, this is like the Wendy theory.
Yeah.
Of Harry Potter.
So yeah, obviously, yeah, it's a huge hit, and it feels like the premise is so generic that why didn't anyone think of this before? Like crafting a fun fantasy world with a young boy wizard that everybody can sort of inject themselves into this character and sort of feel like they're a part of the story. Everybody wants that, right? Everyone wants to be that diamond in the rough that ends up being this person of consequence.
I do have a theory about this, actually. Like, a real one, not the Harry Potter is a sort of psychotic break one.
Well,
so, a lot of, like, great works of literature are from England. You think of Shakespeare, Tolkien.
Never heard of them.
All these people. And, like, these very imaginative works of art. So,
yeah.
That's because the weather fucking sucks. Just about anywhere else in the world, you can fucking go have a good time outside. In England, you are stuck inside. It's dreary. It's cold all the time. So what do? You gotta let your imagination be your escape.
The flaw with that is, how come there isn't better writers in Florida then? Because it's either boiling hot or it's just the fucking rain. I mean...
Florida has some good writers. Like Zora Neale Hurston. She's actually from fucking Maitland.
Alligator Cunningham?
who's the? I mean, I don't know, he's from Florida. He died in Florida. The guy that,
as does everyone,
Ernest Hemingway.
Waiting room.
Yeah, he died in the Keys, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah. What? What are we? I don't even know where we're going with this. But you're. I think there is a point to that. And I think that's the other thing is that also, like, you know, like American English wasn't even accepted as a main means of art, writing art, until like Mark Twain, honestly.
Mm.
Sort of made it acceptable to write American English as a means of
which is snobbish and elitist. The entire English language is a slang language, not just the American version.
I mean, I can read like Edgar Allan Poe, and he's an American, but he sure writes British.
It feels he sure does.
It feels British when you read it.
Yeah, just like there's the sort of dread of just from existing.
That dry, cold, pale existence.
That's England.
Yeah.
So
at any rate, yeah,
Harry Potter.
So J.K. Rowling will be made a billionaire from this shit, and you know, like, again, I think it's a really fantastic world that was crafted here.
Oh, you took the world by storm.
You guys have read the books, right?
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, I've read all the books. I love them.
John, you really should learn to read.
No, I will not.
I'll make a graphic novel someday.
I mean, we'll have X-Men in it because I'm down.
Yeah. Harry Potter meets the X-Men.
Was kind of like an interesting like moment in time for fantasy novels, because, you know, like we've talked a bunch of times, we've referenced like the satanic panic of the 80s, and this like seems like it'd be material to be ripe for this sort of panic, but
yeah,
I mean, it never really received this sort of like religious backlash that a lot of the things akin to like magic and sorcery would receive.
Yeah.
No, nobody freaked out about Harry Potter and teaching the children to do magic and witchcraft.
Yeah, I mean, I think that...
A little bit.
I think Wes is right. I think that there was a little
There was
bit
some,
of
like, oh, it's witchcraft. Like,
but
I
not
think,
nearly to the extent.
Didn't your mom do something to a degree with this? Like, she didn't want somebody reading this because I had witchcraft?
Not that I'm aware. But we never speak.
I could be wrong. I could be wrong about this. But one of my friend's parents, like, you can't read that. There's witchcraft in it. Like, it's...
I don't know. I think that it's such a whimsical world that it's hard to if you actually sat down and just simply read the book, it's hard to read that and be like, oh, I don't know, This is truly and deeply satanic.
So this boy, he goes
he's
to...
He's talking to snakes.
He goes to school and he learns about potions and he learns about defense against the dark arts and he learns about geology. What are the other things?
They don't ever teach him how to read. They don't teach him English history.
Nope.
No, they don't teach him anything about actual science.
Nope. Because they're no magic because they have magic.
But they take potions. And he breaks his arm. Playing a sports game.
Oh, that's right. They play the sports game, riding on the brooms.
Yeah.
Do they do that in the first?
Feet in the air.
Yeah. In that first movie.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. He's the youngest seeker. He's the youngest seeker ever. And there's this kid
Woods. Because the entire world revolves around him.
He really is Zach Morris. He is Zach Morris of the Wizarding world. Yeah. Everything revolves around him.
And you can see, like, you just imagine all the other like classmates. See, like, he's got his core group of friends with the ginger and the girl.
Yeah.
And like you can just feel the eyes rolling all around, like of this fucking guy.
I think it's a really good point where it's like, you know, if you were just there's probably kids that just wanted to go to fucking school.
Yeah.
Go to school.
Get like, a degree. They're not even there by choice. Like their parents sent them there.
Yeah. Like I have to go to wizard school. I got to get a degree, and I'm gonna get a job, and I'm gonna have some kids or something. I don't know. I'm gonna figure my shit out. But I don't care about getting into a war over some fucking kid named Harry Potter who's just, you know, so full of himself.
Yeah.
F this kid.
Then all the teachers love him,
right?
Except for Alan Rickman.
Mm-hmm. And Alan Rickman's got a conflicted relationship with him because of his. You know, there's all this stuff that will play out. We're going to talk about one of these movies a year. I mean, we'll talk more about this shit. I don't know, but yeah, I think it's a really good start to the series. And again, we're going to see people like Emma Watson and Daniel Radcliffe on top of them, working with tons of other great actors, like established great actors. So. Do you guys have like favorite characters?
I don't know.
I liked Alan Rickman.
Alan Rickman was good.
Snape is one of the best characters in the series for sure.
And what's his face? That played Sirius Black. What's his face?
Oh, Gary Oldman.
Yeah, Gary Oldman.
Not in this shows movie, up.
Though. Not in this one. Not until the third one.
Yeah, two of my favorite characters haven't even been introduced yet. Of all characters, one of my favorite is Creature. I love Creature.
He's this so angry much little house.
Oh, he's great. He's always got a comment. He's always got something to say about the stupid mudbloods. He hates them. I love it.
Are you talking about in the movie or in the book? I mean, because you read the books, right?
Yeah.
You just okay.
I mean,
okay.
He's
you're just talking about the character in general.
Yeah, okay. I love the character, and I like Luna. I like Luna Lovegood a lot.
Yeah, Luna's really fun. Yeah. I mean, who doesn't like Luna?
Yeah.
No idea who that is.
Yeah, he'll get to her eventually. Yeah.
So, budget. We got to do the budget. I think you're first this time, or am I?
Mm.
It doesn't matter. 100 million.
Yeah, that was my guess.
Okay, if you want 100...
120.
Okay.
It was 125.
Oh, I did again.
What do you think this thing made?
Oh, 700.
900 million.
Almost a billion. $965 million dues on a 2.5 hour runtime.
Mm. Oh, that is a long movie for children.
Did you guys actually rewatch this?
No.
Oh, I did.
I've seen it multiple times.
Yeah. There's also, I think last year, they actually made a retrospective where they interviewed all the cast members and stuff and talked about what it was like making the movie and everything.
I do not really enjoy it, to be honest, because I just find them really annoying.
Oh, the cast members talking
about that shit? Just the movie in general at this point.
I mean, it is a series of movies.
I'm like, oh, just shut up right now. I don't...
It is a series of movies that will, in a very literal sense, mature as they go on, because the characters will get older, the writing will mature, because it's going to take on more serious subjects.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't actually seen a Harry Potter movie since... The seventh one was in two parts, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So in seven part one, the movie ends with the little troll dude dying.
Yep.
And me and Des were in a movie theater.
Dobby.
Yeah. And he dies, and like everyone is super sad. Des is crying. The other people in the theater around us were crying. And I'm looking at it, and I'm looking at Des, and I said, Des, who the fuck was that?
Honestly, I hate Dobby. I really don't like Dobby at all.
You got what you deserve, then.
I mean, in the books, that was my least favorite part of the books whenever they did stuff with the... What were they?
House elves?
They were house elves. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's what Creature is. And I love Creature.
Because I
mean, I'm not against the house elves. Creature's like the best character
in certain
ever.
In books, they're like discussing about like getting rights for the house elves. I'm like, just skip this chapter entirely. I don't give a fuck. Just leave them enslaved. I don't care.
Well, that's one of those things that people kind of get pissy about, where they're like, oh, why didn't we have 5 minutes discussing the whole house elf thing that Hermione was about, and like all that they did was give her a little pin. That, and I was like, The fact that they serviced the franchise by giving her a pin is like, oh my god, like, be happy. That thing was fucking annoying.
Yeah, that chapter, that, oh, every single time that came up, it's like, I don't give a fuck about these elves. Give them all socks. I don't care. Just get them away from me.
I thought they didn't want clothes.
Well, they had to be given clothes in order to get their freedom.
Yeah.
Oh, they're an enslaved race?
Oh, yeah, they're enslaved.
Oh, that's not cool.
They have these little potato sacks.
Like, the concept isn't cool, but at the same time, I don't give a fuck about them. Like, I'm against slavery, but...
Well, I mean, they talk about it. Like, I mean, the fucking Weasleys don't have a house elf. A house elf is a sign of luxury. You know, it's like the really...
Old money.
Yeah, old money has house elves. Kind of thing.
Does he ever set creature free, or did he just leave him enslaved in that house?
Creature knows he's in charge. Like, again, if you just read Creature, like, his I don't give a fuck attitude is so refreshing in this series.
We got anything about spy games? I have no idea what this movie is.
This is this is one of those generic thrillers. Mm. As I remember, this is the one that has...
Brad Pitt
in it, and he is like a spy that's captured behind enemy lines, and then whoever it is.
But this isn't behind enemy lines. This is a movie that's coming out
still this month.
yeah. Again, that's how generic all this is. Yeah, he gets. And is Robert Redford? Is that the other guy in it? I think Robert.
I don't actually know this movie. I looked it up on IMDb real quick.
Was he still like making? Oh yeah, because I think A Perfect Storm was after this.
Yeah, so at any rate, the premise is that they got to go back and get this guy who's been captured. And I don't even know if they succeed. I don't care. I mean, it's Tony Scott, and Tony Scott makes good movies. I mean, I think like he's a great director. I just didn't care to see this one.
I bet a cop car flipped. It was Tony Scott.
Oh, yeah, you can fucking know that for sure happened, man. What do you think it cost? Unless we got more.
I know nothing. I can't even guess.
$115.
Oh,
you guys weren't even going to guess.
I wasn't going to guess.
I was going to go low, though. I was going to take his $50 million.
There's no way I would have... Yeah, I know nothing about this movie.
I'm sure it's a super flashy movie. Because, Tony Scott spends a lot of money making movies. That's for sure.
That's a good point.
It's not cheap flipping cop cars.
Yeah.
$150 million is what it cost? I don't think it made its money back. I'll say $80
million. $70.
$140.
Oh, good for them.
So it actually did pretty good, yeah. Did you write down In the Bedroom?
I did.
You did?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is that all we need to say about it?
93% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, get the fuck out of here. I don't know anything about this movie.
I want this entire movie to take place in the bedroom.
I don't even think I finished this movie. It was brutal as fuck to watch. It's like, what was it? Cider House Rules? Do you guys remember that movie?
Yeah.
Imagine that, but it's like even worse.
Like, is it like one of these
so
like
sad
coming of age sad dramas kind of thing?
As I remember, the general premise is like the younger son of a guy of a family is having an affair with a married woman whose husband kills the kid brutally, and the town has arrested him but releases him on bail.
A New England couple's college-aged son dates an older woman who has two small children and an unwelcome ex-husband.
That's what it was. Yeah, he's an ex-husband.
So it's the graduate with a murder.
Yeah, so imagine that the ex-husband kills the son.
Right.
And is now living in the town free to do what he wants.
After murdering.
The parents, in the same town as the parents of the dead son.
Mm.
It's just, it's just so rough a movie to watch. And again, this is from... watching it like 20 years ago, like what kind of around the time this came out, maybe like I was probably 2004 or 5 when I actually sat down and watched this one, or at least attempted to. I don't even think I finished it. But again, it's 93% on Rotten Tomatoes, which again it's a dark one.
Critic bait.
Yeah.
$40 million, that's what it cost.
30.
A really crisp budget of $1.7 million.
Oof.
Yeah. Gross.
$15 million.
30.
42. Did well.
All right.
I didn't write anything else down about it, but I'm fairly certain this thing's going to get a bunch of get nominated at least for a bunch of awards, specifically for like screenwriting and stuff.
We'll find out.
Yep.
Wes, tell us everything you remember about Behind Enemy Lines.
I actually do enjoy this movie. I don't know why.
I know you
it's
do.
Just, it's, I know you do. I don't know what it is about this movie. I enjoyed it.
Is this
Owen Wilson is a...
As an action star.
Yeah. It
totally is, believable. Perfectly cast.
Oh, it's so nonsense. So, him and...
I'm behind enemy lines. Wow.
He's the co-pilot.
It's like they used a template from a Bourne movie for the cover of this.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Is the Bourne identity out yet?
He's like the guy who sits behind the jet... pilot.
Like a navigator?
Jet. Yeah, the navigator. He's the navigator in a jet, and they get bored because they haven't done anything or whatever, and it's like Christmas Eve or something, and they have to go out
on duty. He's lost on Christmas?
I think it's like Christmas or
something.
Oh, no. It's been a long ass time since they've seen this movie, but they get shot down, and then his pilot friend gets killed, and so it's just him trying to make it back behind enemy lines.
Yeah,
and the entire movie is just him running through the fucking country just trying to book it and get it back, and
mm-hmm.
gets incriminating evidence about something and about mass burial site.
Because the more he knows, the bigger target he's gonna
be. Yeah.
That's how you raise the stakes.
Yeah. I mean, it's a dumb movie, but I still enjoy it.
Mm. You are correct.
I would like to rewatch this movie. It's been a long time.
On Christmas.
Was it good? Ah, it was Christmas. Fuck yeah.
That's absolutely right.
And it's got
Gene Hackman.
Gene Hackman, that's his name.
In two movies.
And his name is Leslie. That's... I always remember that. It's like, that's almost my name.
What's Owen Wilson's name in this?
I have no idea.
You just remember that his name was Leslie.
I just remember that Gene Hackman's character's name is Leslie.
His name is Navy Pilot Lieutenant Chris Longhorn Burnett.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
All right.
He is just not even remotely convincing enough to have a name like that.
Nope. Budget.
God, this is just... 100 mil.
Oh, this movie's expensive. 120.
40.
Get God, the fuck out of here!
There's like jets exploding and they're running across the country.
Hear this footage from Top Gun.
You know what this tells me? Scene where landmines go off?
You know what this tells me, though? Tony Scott needs to tone it down. He needs to be a bit more frugal.
He's
spending way too much.
God, that's bonkers off 40 mil.
Yeah, that's what it says, man. 40 mil.
Gene Hackman's in it.
Yeah,
but they don't explode.
He just did
him.
The heist.
The heist cost 39. This cost exactly $1 million.
He's probably getting residuals from the heist, which is why he was able to take lower. What did this movie make, Wes?
Oh, 100. I don't know. I don't fucking know. I'm terrible at this.
You're going to say 100 again? I'm going to say 120 million again.
91. Mm. Wes is closer to the pen.
I would have thought that would have been... Anyway, last one. Out Cold.
Yeah, I actually watched this one a long time ago.
Thumbs up?
I've actually seen it. No, it's actually really garbage. I remember watching this because I was really early to the whole Zach Galifianakis thing. And I wanted to see this movie strictly because he's in it.
God, I hate Zach Galifianakis.
But he's in this as
don't be
just,
mean.
It's
he listens.
Total,
I mean, it's fine. He can know how much I despise him.
It's total one note shit. He's like narcoleptic. It's called Out Cold. The idea being that these guys are looking after. It's like Wet Hot American Summer.
A snowboarder plans for his own snowboard park.
Oh, I know this movie.
It goes awry when his ex girlfriend gets back into town.
I know this movie.
Super shitty, cheesy, generic premise. The Malloys are the directors of it, and they're mostly known for directing music videos. I would not recommend watching this. I watched it 20 years ago, and it sucked. So I wouldn't recommend revisiting it.
Wow, I didn't even realize Zach Galifianakis is in this movie.
Yeah. Again, I was just like looking for anything that the guy had done, and I saw that this was one of his few credited things at that time.
I'd rather watch Johnny Tsunami than this.
This movie cost.
Oh, yeah.
There's snowboarding in it. There's some stunts. Ooh. This movie cost $30
million. 45.
24.
All right.
Yeah. What do you think it made?
It cost $24 million. This movie did not do well. It made $10
million.
30. It outperformed Wet Hot American Summer.
No!
By making $14 million.
I want to go kill myself.
Yeah.
Wait, how much did it make?
14.
Okay.
That changes things.
So it didn't do great. At least there's that.
So you're not going to kill yourself.
No, with well, let's not rule it out as a possibility.
There will still be self-harmed.
Okay, well, Anything else we need to address here before we're done?
No, no.
Jeez. Okay, so next up, I don't know, what do we want to do next? We've done a mini show, we've done a retro show. Pokemon
comes out in
it's gonna be a week and a day. Yeah.
Are we just leaving that for the last song? Are we just doing the official show and then just glossing over Pokemon and then we'll end the month with Pokemon?
I don't know. That might be what we do. Anyway, we'll figure that out a different time. We're going to close it out here. That's it. We're down the end.
So long.
See ya. I'll take some.